Good evening, and this is WORT, listener-sponsored radio in Madison, Wisconsin at 89.9 FM. Good evening, and welcome to this edition of Perpetual Notion Machine. My name is Patrick Seibel, and I'm pleased to produce tonight's show on the subject of active volcanism in Iceland. Our featured expert is Thorvaldur Thordarson, professor in petrology and volcanology at the University of Iceland. Thor has done global research in Hawaii, New Zealand, Australia, and Scotland, and now joins us from his home in Reykjavik. Thanks for doing the show during such a busy time.
Oh, you're welcome.
Okay.
Well, good evening.
Thank you. But first, by way of disclosure, most of what I learned on the subject of volcanology was from our daughter, a UW student who spent a semester abroad at your school. So should we start with some content or basics on Iceland's geology?
Yeah, we can. I mean, I'm glad that you learned from your daughter, because that means that we were also reasonably successful in delivering our messages in terms of our teaching. But we do get a lot of exchange students, both from the United States and North America in general, actually, and also from Europe and even as far as Australia. So it's a vibrant community of exchange students here. We come for a semester or two to Iceland to study. And it is kind of understandable that they want to come in, because Iceland is a very active place, geologically speaking, in more than one way. So we have, of course, as probably most people know, we have the hot spot. So it's a unusually active region of in terms of volcanism. So there's a lot of magma that comes out. It's one of the most active, volcanically active place on planet Earth at the moment. And the reason for that is because we have a mantle plume underneath, rising up underneath Iceland, but we also have the mid-ocean ridge crossing Iceland. So you have these two really big structures of deep, deeply rising plumes from 600 to even as much as 1,300 kilometers depth, rising up underneath Iceland. And they have momentum, and they have such a momentum that they actually have lifted the mid-ocean ridge out of the sea. They've actually raised the mid-ocean ridge several thousand meters to actually make it into the island that we know of as Iceland.
So it's the combination of the plates, the juncture of the plates, as well as the plume that makes it unique.
It is. It is exactly that. And it... The only other place that we see this on Earth today is the Afar Triangle, north of Ethiopia. So it is quite a unique in that respect. Now the other aspect of Iceland is because we are located at boundary between major climate masses. The weather in Iceland is quite dynamic. We have a fair amount of rain, so we got good rivers who are actually quite erosive, and they're running down reasonably steep slopes. So we have a lot of erosion in Iceland as well. So of course we have glaciers, and they are also cutting down the rocks. And in spite of all this erosion from glaciers and rivers, volcanism is in such an abundance that it still builds up an island. So the positive or the constructive forces actually are winning the battle against the destructive forces in Iceland.
Oh, that's a very interesting perspective. I've thought about the tectonic plates, but the lifting part of it is something. You look at the ocean floor, and that rift valley goes the whole length of the Atlantic.
But yes, it does. And see, Iceland rises more than 3,000 meters above the seafloor around it. And then you have another 1,000 meters of landmass on top of that. So it's a big plateau. And it's close to about 300 square kilometers in area. And the volume of magma that has actually produced all this is on the order of, these are big numbers, 8 million cubic kilometers of molten rock.
That's mind-boggling. And this recent activity now, isn't there kind of a range of activity, kind of a diagonal across Iceland?
Yeah. So what we have in Iceland is because because of this interaction between the two structures, the mantle plume and the mid-ocean ridge, neither of them are stationary. So both of them are moving a little bit. So there is a little bit of an adjustment because of that movement off the mid-ocean ridge plate boundary across Iceland. So it shifts a little bit further to the east. So we get actually quite a complicated suture or a plate boundary across Iceland. And we have segments which are purely extensional, so where basically the plates are just moving away from each other, and what we call rifting. And if you pull them apart, and you're basically rifting them apart, you form a gap, and the magma comes up and fills in that gap. But we also have boundaries which are actually more similar to what people know in terms of the San Andreas Fault, where actually the plates are moving laterally past each other, and they're rubbing against each other, and that actually causes quite a large earthquake. So we can have quite large earthquakes here in Iceland. Biggest earthquakes that we've felt here is approaching 7, magnitude 7 earthquakes.
So there's quite a variety here. What is this? What is this latest? You had a lot of earthquakes recently. In the news just this month, it's almost seemed constant.
We've had close to 50,000 earthquakes, I think, since 23rd of February. So in about a month. And that's all been concentrated on one short segment of the plate boundary just south of the capital, Reykjavik. It's only about 20, maybe a 25 kilometers away from south of Reykjavik, 15 to 18 miles, if that helps a bit better. So it's not far away. And it so happens that at this location, this is called Reykjanes Peninsula. That's where the plates are actually moving laterally or rubbing laterally against each other. And that actually causes the earthquakes. Most of the big earthquakes that we feel are linked to that. And basically what this zone, which we have here in the Reykjanes Peninsula, is the connection between the mid-ocean ridge to the south of Iceland, which is called the Reykjanes Ridge, and the main volcanic zones in the central part of Iceland, and which actually produce most of our volcanoes. But this movement is not just parallel lateral movement. It's a little bit of an extension. So it's a little bit oblique. And because of that, you open up a little bit. And if you open up a little pathway for molten rock from deep down to actually find its way towards the surface. And that's why we have this eruption.
So this different to go around Iceland. You've got some areas that are been ripped open, like a cataclysmic tear, like you talked about, like the rift. Is that the there's a trail that goes there, Lagavegur Trail goes through up into this area.
Yes, so we have what we call the axial rift, and they. Go sort of zigzag across Iceland from southwest to northeast. And these axial rays, they produce volcanoes that are primarily lava-producing eruptions. Not very explosive. Occasionally, we have explosive eruptions that can be quite intense, but usually very short-lived. And those are was silicic or rhyolitic magma, so they're much richer in silica and very viscous, much more viscous than the basaltic magmas that form most of the lava flows that we have. Now, because of this relative movement between the mantle plume, which is underneath Iceland, and the mid-ocean ridge boundary that goes across Iceland, the axial rifts tend to shift their position with time. And we are having one of those shifts actually in action right now. So there's a belt of volcanoes in West Iceland that goes from roughly just east of Reykjavik and through the place we call Þingvelli, where the parliament used to be, which is the old parliament flats. And you can really see the rifting in that area because the lake sits in a rift basin. Mm-hmm. And but then further east, where you have the well-known Landmannalaugar and the Laugavegur hiking trail, and you have Hekla volcano, Katla volcano, all these big volcanoes in Iceland. That's the new axial rift which is in making. And it's gradually taking over from the one in the west. And that's where we have also most of our big explosive eruptions. So we have big volcanoes there, and they can produce very powerful explosive eruption of really both basaltic and silicic composition. And the tephra, or the ash that these eruptions produce, have been dispersed all the way to the pole and to Greece in the Mediterranean.
Is that I'll try to pronounce it, Eyjafjallajökull?
Eyjafjallajökull, yes.
And that was in 2010?
Yes.
And is that, that's a more explosive blowout type?
Yes. Eyjafjallajökull is also in that, it's next to Katla. And well, as the U.S. military referred to it, E-15, because it starts with an E and then has 15 letters.
that's a lot easier.
And Eyjafjallajökull is right in this zone where we have most of those big explosive volcanoes.
Now, you mentioned something, Thor, about viscosity of the magma. Mm-hmm. Is that a major factor then in the explosiveness, or what?
It does. It does have a huge impact on whether it actually is one of the main factors that determine whether eruption will become explosive or not. Because if the magma remains very fluid, if it's basaltic, low in silica, and remains very fluid during the eruption, the gases that are actually dissolved in the magma way below, they exsolve as the magma comes towards the surface. Because it's kind of similar like when we pop the cap on the soda bottle, and then especially after we've shaken it, then we get an eruption, right? And if the liquid is very fluid, then all the bubbles can easily escape through it. Mm-hmm. And it just, you just have gas streaming out into the atmosphere. Now, but if the magma is very viscous, then the bubbles have a harder time rising through. But you're still putting more and more gas into the bubble. You're building up the pressure. And eventually, the pressure overcomes the strength of the viscous liquid around it, and then you have explosive eruptions.
So the bubbles as well as the viscosity together. Yep. Okay. And how would you characterize this latest eruption, then? Is this... it's on a explosivity or a scale or relative to the other volcanoes in Iceland.
It's a how do I best describe it? It's a very tidy eruption. It's low intensity, and at the moment it's also fairly small. It's now been erupting since Friday. I think it was like 10 o'clock Friday night our time when it started. So it's been going about 4 days now. And it's low, what we talk in discharge or fusion rate, but it's really just the flux out of the vent. So the flux is actually quite low. It's only about 5 to 10 cubic meters per second. So it just rolls out, it bubbles a little bit. It's a very soft boiling, but it's steady and hasn't changed at all. It just keeps coming out. So it's quite different from many other eruptions that we have observed and witnessed here in Iceland, because most of them, they start with a big bang. You know, the greatest intensity in the beginning, and that tapers off reasonably quickly. But, you know, this one never went through any of that. It's almost like it just barely turned on the tap and it just started dripping out.
So this one could go for quite a while then, yeah?
Yeah, I think it might, actually, because... You know, if you go back to this notion of a eruption starting really with great intensity at the beginning, and then sort of tapering off quite rapidly, and then becoming low intensity very quickly, and even just dying out, that means you have a really highly pressurized container which keeps the magma prior to eruption, and you poked an opening in that, you know, the internal pressure just basically ruptured the roof and the magma shot up. And that means you pressurized this container, and when you open it up, you decompress it, and the minute you decompress it enough, then the eruption is over. You know, you just basically, then you lost the momentum. This particular eruption didn't do anything like that. It did pressurize and use its buoyancy and pressure to pressurize sort of the pathway it came up and found a way to the surface. But it never really built up a huge overpressure. It just did this really in a very passive way and found an opening, and now the valve has been taken off and it's opened up and it just oozes out. And I think that's one of the reasons why it might last for a long time, because we're getting about the same amount coming into the system from below, where magma is made by melting of the mantle, where the deeper rocks within our Earth, and what we're taking out. So you got this balance, but they're roughly about the same amount put in as we take out. And if you maintain that situation, then we can have this go for quite a long time.
So is this similar then to the when you were in Hawaii? You Kilauea, where there's a steady building of the land. There is this a similar type of event, or is it?
It has a lot of resemblance to the. Long eruption that they had on Kilauea volcano in Hawaii called Pu'o'o, which actually started with a little bit of a flare in 1983, but 1986 it settled down on roughly about the same flux as we are having from our current eruption, right around 10 cubic meters per second. And it maintained that flux until 2018, when the eruption stopped. That's 32 years. And I think what we're looking at here in Iceland is a similar thing. And I don't see anything, you know, that argues against it, that this may actually last for the number of years or even decades.
Well, I read that this sounds, you're saying it's a tidy eruption, and it seems like a perfect kind of a spectator event for we've seen recent footage of a lot of people observing, and how would you suggest people observe this, or how soon do we need to come to Iceland if we want to see it?
Well, I wish I could tell you that exactly, you know, with confidence. It's a very dangerous thing to promise something and then if the volcano decides to do something totally opposite to what you were hoping it would do. I hope this actually does last, because it is, like I said, it's quite a tidy eruption. It's very observable. And people can get reasonably close without putting themselves in danger. Now, there are dangers around any eruption, and like just this one, like any other. And this one is releasing a fair bit of gas, and the gas is slightly heavier than the atmosphere, especially the CO2 or the carbon dioxide part of the gas that is coming out, and it's, you know, kind of a resides in lows. And you don't want to end up in a pool of CO2, because that is not very good for us. And so those are kind of things that one has to think about when you're close to the eruption site. You don't want to be in the low-lying areas. You definitely don't want to go right in front of a moving lava flow, because you never know when it might break out and come at you fairly quickly. It might come at you at speeds which you can't run from. And so, but, you know, people can get actually quite close. I mean, with several hundred feet of the eruption site, and you're still safe. So from that point of view, I think it is quite an exciting event, and hopefully it will last for a long time, and people can come and see an eruption in a nice setting and quite safe.
Are there other dangerous gases? I mean, sometimes you hear about H2S, or is there a smell to this that warns you also?
There is a little bit of sulfur smell. So there is a fair bit of sulfur that comes out in this eruption as well. So it's similar to the vog that came out in the eruption at Kilauea, Puuoa eruption, that we mentioned earlier. So several thousand tons a day of SO2, and of course that is carried up into the atmosphere by the eruptive plume and then dispersed away from shore. So it dilutes as it moves away, but it can be at dangerous levels very close to the vents. And also we have fluorine and chlorine, and those can form acids, which are not very nice when you end up interacting with them. So,
any other advice you have for people to follow this event or to learn from it?
Well, there are a number of ways people can. I mean, best and of course the most enjoyable part is if you can go there and watch it yourself and just observe it from a safe distance, because that there's a special feeling about that. I mean, when you feel the heat coming from the lava flow, and there is a certain smell from it too, which you probably won't forget. But there are also a number of ways that you can. There's at least two, if not three, live streaming from the eruption site. And so you can watch, you know, 24 hour a day if you want.
The volcano cam.
Yeah, exactly. And I have one on right now.
Oh, that's really lit up.
Yeah, it is. And if you really want to see the glowing thing, then in, you know, either in daybreak or you know, sort of as the evening is approaching, then that's when you've seen the most spectacular sort of glowing aspect of the eruption.
Are you going there with your students or other people, or what is your plan?
Yeah, the department has planned, and they just did it today. They hiked out with a group of students, to the eruption site for them to observe. Right now, I'm very occupied with actually following and monitoring the eruption. So I'm going up there, or someone in our group here, which are the volcanology group, we go up once a day to, once every other day to do certain measurements, get the temperature of the magma, do thermal imaging of active flow fronts, characterizing the type of lava that is coming out, plans to look at the thermal budget of some of the lava rivers. And of course, we do sampling. You know, we collect samples from the glowing and running lava, actually. So just told you, said, not, don't go in front of the lava, but the scientists do. We go in there and with protective gear. We've got gas masks and gas meters, and we have oxygen with us, in oxygen tanks with us, just in case. And of course, we also experience in looking at what the lava is doing, so we can avoid the most dangerous places. But we do try to sample the hot lava, and we cool it down in a bucket with full of water. So we quench it, as we call, and because we want to try to get as much information about the state of the liquid as it is when it was moving. So we want to, and if we quench it, we will stop it from forming more crystals, and most of it will just be glass, and then we get information about how much crystal growth took place as the magma flowed from the vent to the place of where we were sampling.
Oh, it sounds like a lot of work right now. It's something you live for, isn't it?
It is. Well, yeah, absolutely. So we don't get that many eruptions. You know, people might think that we're always, you know, looking at eruptions, but here in Iceland we get eruptions. One eruption every 3 years on average, but each eruption is different. Like this one is very different from the last one, even though they're both lava producing. This one is quite much weaker and going slower. But then we also have explosive eruptions, like we had an AFET 2010 and Grímsvötn 2011, and so forth. So some of them are out within glaciers, some of them are outside of the glaciers. But the whole thing is that each eruption is really an experiment in our laboratory. And we have to try to measure and learn as much from each experiment as we possibly can.
Well, it's been wonderful talking. You're in a perfect place for such studies. And we really thank you very much for sharing this during this real busy time.
You're welcome, and thank you.
Okay. All right. Take care. Be safe. And yeah. Good luck with the research.
Thank you. Okay. Appreciate it. Take care.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Lonesome outer space invader blasting through the night. Tuning in the soul music on the satellite. On that low-down funky rhythm. Tuning in the local scene.